record.
And off to you, pal.
Well, I just want to say thank you very much for downloading this podcast. It is actually the Lean Into Artcast, brought to you by myself, Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com, and of course, leanintoart.com, which is this online art center for, it's a learning network, and we do workshops and all that kind of stuff for creative artists of any ilk. And we've got Jersey Drozd with me.
Jersey Drozd. That's how those automated phone machines always say my name. Jersey Drozd. Like when my dentist calls about an appointment to remind me about an appointment the next day. And I just got one because I'm getting a root canal tomorrow. Yeah, all right. Woo! Although I've been told it's not as bad as the TV makes it out to be. It's not tomorrow. It's in 2 days. Anyway, I'm Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com because I think they're really great. And kidsreadcomics.org, which we'll talk about a little bit later because that's coming up. So, hey, Rob, what's new?
What's new is I'm kind of wishing a robot would pronounce my voice in some way that had relationship to my career and life choices, you know? Because you've got, it's like Drozd, right?
Drozd, yes. It almost is. Yeah. But if it's Drozd would be the right way to say it. That'd be the Drozd. You know, wow. Say with that urgency and intensity of a angry Russian.
That's tough sounding.
Yeah, Yezhe Drozd. But whoa. It does sound tough when you say it that way. And then when you say it with my voice, Jersey Drozd, then it sounds oh so silly. So what have you been up to? It's been it seems like it's been a long time since I last talked to you, but it hasn't been that long, has it?
No. Nope. We have our podcast recording schedule, but we've been a bit busy of late. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of UX consulting, and I've also been working on my game development class.
Nothing. Anything new to report on the game class?
And I've actually been working on getting the Polytechnicast back underway. So I actually look for a couple of those that I should be uploading pretty soon. Actually, they should be live before this goes out, this podcast. As far as the class, I've been working on the whole how the slides are presented thing, because there really isn't a slide tool that like a PowerPoint or a PDF or a stack of images that, or even my beloved Prezi.
Yeah.
It could animate it in an interesting way, and I could, you know, it's fun to narrate how Prezi animates things, but I need to be so nonlinear.
Yeah. See, that's where I think a whiteboard might be your friend in that situation.
It could. That would be pretty cool.
Because, I mean, back when I was teaching in Detroit, I remember not having access to computer projectors, so I had to resort to the old-fashioned overhead projector with transparencies. And I started out, like, in the first 2 weeks, I started out with all these pre-prepared transparencies where I got, like, the kinds you can print out on a laser or inkjet printer. But by week six, I was all to blank transparencies because I found it so liberating to be able to just work with what I was getting in the room at the time and go in whatever direction I wanted to, and not going like, okay, well, everybody hold tight because I got to put up this next transparency and then we got to talk about that. And I know you were talking about something interesting, but you know what I mean? Nonlinear teaching, nonlinear, especially in a game, right? It seems like a whiteboard, or maybe just put a camera on an overhead projector. it'll look totally like 1978. Get those brown tinted glasses.
That would actually suit the workshop quite well, but I've got an urge for it to feel a bit like playing a card game. So it's a combination of like your programming and playing Pokemon and
ice machine. Make it look like a smoky room.
Exactly. With the dry ice machine, a little bit of more contemplative, soothing metal in the background. Perhaps, it would feel a bit Cirque du Soleil-like.
Oh, man. I cannot wait for this class.
Now we've talked it up too much.
I know. Now we've set expectations way too high.
The whiteboard approach would totally rock. I actually saw a video on YouTube, which I'm trying to recall what it is. I think I tweeted it. I'll have to dig it up for the show notes. But it was, let's see, a guy who helped co-design the first laptop computer. Mm. And he's giving a human-computer interaction presentation at Stanford University. And he had just written a book at the time that I'm sure he was touring and doing lectures for the book and whatnot at this time. And anyway, he had some video snippets that came with the DVD in the book or whatever. But one of them was, boy, this is a long walk for this example.
I'm guilty of worse, Rob. Keep going.
The guy that was being interviewed essentially narrated and drew everything, and it all made sense perfectly. And it was pretty much, it was excellent, iconic art.
Yeah.
It was as if that's how that guy walks around all day. He's got one arm permanently holding a large notepad, and he's got a big old marker in the other hand, and he's always like talking and drawing.
That's awesome. Thought,
wow, I would love to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, I'm not going to profess to be that good, but yeah, I lean on dry erase boards more than anything else anymore when I'm teaching. Just a PowerPoint or any kind of deck feels so restrict or confining these days. It's one thing if you're doing a talk, right? If you're asked to do a talk and everybody's just there to like pay attention and then ask questions afterwards, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But even then, it's like what I did this talk for. Gosh, we're going to talk about teaching for too long now. I'll wrap this up in 30 seconds. When I did that talk at the or class for the information school at the University of Michigan, it really was like they expected a deck, you know. And then I was going to do a talk, and then it was going to be followed by an activity. But I broke it up. Here's 3 minutes of talking, followed by thinking and drawing activity. Now we're going to talk for a few more minutes and look at slides. And I'm going to ask you questions about the slides. We're going to discuss the slides, and then we're going to do another activity where we draw and do something with our hands, you know. And it's really out of selfishness. I just get bored otherwise. I don't want to just drone on. I mean, as much as I love comics, I just don't want to just like talk at somebody if I'm going to be in a room with a person. But anyway, I'll be interested to see how you solve that puzzle, you know, whether you use whiteboard or what else. But
cool,
you know
me
what?
Too.
I know we set the expectations high, but this is my prediction for the video game workshop. When you finish it, you will get the applause you deserve.
Oh, snap.
See, we can't do that. The moment we laugh at that, we've given it away that was our segue. You know, it's clumsy. It's clumsy. We got to work on our production values, Rob. We can't be, you know, sniggering. Well, when the comedians usually, when they're breaking up in the middle of a skit, that's usually pretty good. But
it's, I don't know. It's tough to say, man. I mean, I guess at least it keeps me on mic. I want to like do a little sort of touchdown dance, you know, that would take a second. That was a segue. That was a mighty segue.
Was it?
Yeah.
I would say it was a ham-fisted segue. It was Donald O'Connor dancing goofily segue. For those of you who are fans of the old timey movies. Getting the applause you deserve, that's our topic for today. And you know what? We didn't take a whole lot of time to do any preliminary notes on this. We kind of talked it out for a little few minutes before we started recording. But you know what? The last two episodes were really, really good. And we deserve to have one where we just kind of wander around a topic again. You know, there was 40 pounds of content in a 20-pound bag in the last two episodes between the art automation episode and the one where I barked everybody's ears off about cartoons. Now let's have a relaxing talk, shall we?
Yes, let's.
So the applause you deserve, what do we mean by this, Rob? Do you want to kick it off with like a thought on this, or do you want me to talk about what's been what's been biting my brain?
I'll take a swing, and if I whiff, I know you have my back.
I'm in the batter's cage.
Yep. So this is, let's see. It's really, really, really tough to create things and put it out there for the world to see and to share. I mean, there's so many aspects, even what I just said, if you can break it down into 100 steps, probably. The act of creating something, what's the something, who are you making it for, how are you making it, how do you get good at it, and then sharing.
Oh, God, I'm already bored, Rob. I just want to make a thing, and I just want to be famous.
You know what? I think all you got to do is just sort of get in someone else's face who is famous already. Pretty sure that works.
Oh, so I'm going to go to Lou Ferrigno at the next Comic-Con.
Yeah. Yep. No. It is a really hard thing to make things and to share them and whatnot. And I think, something that I know I've run into before is, well, okay. Reflecting back when I was first starting to put comics on the internet, and then I started, eventually I got on Twitter and I started mentioning when I would do an update and whatnot. And I started trying to connect and find out, well, who else is making web comics? And feels like a movement or something's going on here, right? How do you connect with these people and stuff, right? So I started following them and finding people that whose work that I that made me laugh or I'd learned from and or was inspired by in some way. So I thought, well, this helps show my voice as a curator and give them a bit of a high five. So I'll retweet things or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But then starting to think, well, how does that work? Well, you see others retweeting things and what's driving that? And some people I noticed, well, they seem to retweet everything. What's that about? And other people are like asking me or asking everyone to, you know, please retweet this and
please RT. And
yeah. And now of course it's like on Facebook plus one, this on Google Plus and for whatever else comes along that we have people socializing in some way to, have this little voting meritocracy thing. They're going to try to sort of find you know, how do I get the masses to become aware of what I'm doing and, you know, ask for others to somehow
help you out,
elect this to that level.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if those top 100 lists are still around. It's been a long time since I swam in those waters of like the web comics community. And I'm doing air quotes when I say that, you know, you remember this? There was like a big thing to do like 5 years ago. Yeah. You know, you enter your comic onto this voting board, and there's a leaderboard of like the top 10 comics that are being voted up by your fans. You put a vote button on your web comic site, right? And then you harangue people to give you a vote. Vote yup, vote yup, vote yup. Gosh, I think I did that for like a week or two. The Internet Archive, if anybody wants to be really persnickety, they can go back and see how long I did it for. But I remember doing it for a very short time and then just felt awful about yelling at my fans to vote for me on something.
Right. Yeah, I've asked people to do it too. And in those early days, I mean, so some of it too is you see, well, here's how the collective tribe of us webcomicers or whatnot are behaving. You know, how does that work?
What you're identifying here is that, okay, so starting out a project, like, and we're really kind of talking to people who are new to making art and sharing it on the internet, or people who are, you know, have been doing it for a little while, but they're still, you know, frustrated or, I would even count myself among those people. I'm frustrated half the time because I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying not to drown. I'm dog paddling the whole time while it seems to me that everybody around me is an Olympic swimmer. Everybody else is Michael Phelps, and they're just cruising by me, and I'm going, help, help. I got water in my eye. You know, okay, so like doing a project itself is really hard. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I got to figure out what's my artistic voice. What kind of characters I want to write about? Is this the story that I want to spend a couple years on, or am I going to get bored with this? And if I get bored with this, or what am I going to do then? Or what happens if my style changes? What kind of tools I'm going to use? Am I going to do this on paper? Am I going to do this digitally? Am I going to color? Is it going to be black and white? How am I going to get this printed if I want to get it printed? Am I going to go to shows? You know, there's a lot to think about just in the execution of the project itself.
Sure, you've given good voice to the anxiety that I think a lot of artists feel.
And there you were to calm us down. Thank you, Rob. Because I was feeling my own heart palpitating just a moment there. But now it's like, now I got to get involved in sharing this stuff and putting it out there. Oh, my gosh. How do you do that? Well, here come the SEO life coaches who are going to give you the five strategies you need in order to sell or get your comic noticed by a million people. How to get your Kickstarter funded in 30 hours or less, you know? Mm. All these people come along with different strategies and rules and like, well, this is the thing that I, and some of them are nice. Some of them are genuinely trying to be helpful, saying this is what worked for me. You know, but you're faced after having the courage to take on all of this creative decision making. Now you got to take on all of this, you know, if you want to do, if you want this to be any kind of like substantial part of your career, if you want to engage in a sustainable trade with your work and is pulling from the Stenzinger coat of arms, you know, you're going to want to engage with people and share and build an audience and whatnot. And so all these people come along with all these strategies. And of course, you know, you don't know what's going to work. You know what feels right and what feels wrong. I mean, I remember doing a couple things where very early on, this is going back a decade, so this is old, useless knowledge, but in terms of internet years. But the link trade thing, where somebody would email me who I've never met before and like, would you like to trade links? And I knew right then and there, like even not being on the internet very long, I was like, nah, I don't feel comfortable doing that because I don't know you. I don't want... I don't know who you are, what you've been doing, what your positions are on things. And also, I don't have the time to investigate that. Let's wait until we've had time to get to know each other, and then we can talk about it. And then if once we get to know each other, and if I like you, and if I believe in your project, then I'll happily put a link without you even linking back to me. You know, I'm going to support the people I believe in and people who are my friends and so on. But anyway, I knew that intuitively. But there were plenty of times where I tried something because, well, it seems like this guy knows what he's talking about and I don't know what I'm doing. And so I made, you know, my share of mistakes, right?
My gosh. Yeah. It seems this guy knows what he's talking about. And yeah, he seems to have a lot more confidence in this realm, or he or she, right, than I do. So I should try what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. So you try lots of things. And I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that like you should be timid about the stuff. You should be willing to make some failures and screw up on this stuff because that's how you learn and that's how you find what's right for you. But it's okay. So the new flavor of the month that led me to this, to suggest this as a topic, and actually my original topic name was begging, and you very, what am I trying to say?
Compassionately.
What? What did you say?
Politically.
I was going to say compassionately.
Okay. Thank you.
Turned it into getting the applause you deserve, which is, I think is much better. It's a much more positive inflection rather than attack begging. Let's talk about the opposite inflection of that, the positive inflection of like, what, why are they begging? Because they're trying to get applause. Well, let's talk about, instead of just saying applause, one big word, let's talk about getting the applause that actually is suited to you. And that's not to talk about classes. That's not to talk about, well, you're a gamma, so you only deserve this much applause. That guy's better than you. He gets a lot more applause. Mm-hmm. No. It's talk about earning the applause that you get versus trying to find a fast way in to that applause. And I think that's where this whole thing, like this flavor of the month of the please retweet. Like, so like in 2002, it was, want to trade links? I'll link to you. Mm-hmm. You link to me. You got an audience. I got an audience. Let's just put links and then we'll have more audience. You know, now you're doing a comic about, political spy thriller. And I'm doing this comic that has a moral at the end of the story where I'm trying to teach kids to be nice. I don't think our audiences have a lot of crossover there anyway. Or even if they were the same, you know, it's just, that's weird. And then later on, it was like the top 100 lists. And then I'm trying to think what was happening between then and now. But nowadays, you know, there was that oatmeal comic, which we can link to in the show notes, which probably a lot of people have seen because this guy gets crazy traffic.
I wish he would mention me.
But it's like how to get more likes on Facebook. And we'll link to it in the show notes. If you haven't read it yet, you should read it. It's pretty funny reading. It's a great comic that clearly defines this whole syndrome of people who are being a little overly exuberant in trying to elicit positive feedback. And I also think of, and I should write this down, Merlin Mann's podcast. He did a guest spot. This was a while back where Dan Benjamin, his co-host, was away. And so he had, I think it was his friend John Roderick on the show. I don't know if you remember this one, but it was a while back. And it was a very grumpy, it was a very disgruntled conversation. And there were many times where, it's called the Back to Work podcast, by the way. But there were many times where I was like, oh, I don't think I'm going to shut this off. But then that John Roderick guy would say something that was very curmudgeonly, but at the same time, there was a nugget of wisdom in there. And one of his gripes was, is that everybody's racing for a thumbs up. Everybody's trying to get a thumbs up.
Yeah.
And instead of just expressing themselves and making something artful that means something to them, they're desperately chasing after, did I do good? Is this good? Did I get enough plus ones on this? Did I get enough likes on this? Did I get enough retweets on this? And before we take it a step further, because we got a lot of different points to kind of hit at this and, you know, not a whole lot of time. I want to make sure that everybody understands that I am not slagging anybody who's trying to promote themselves. As a guy who spends countless hours behind a microphone talking about comics and talking about why he loves comics, dude, I get self-promotion. I try to do my best to be a self-promoter and a promoter of the things that I believe in. But there are times where I personally have had the experience of getting that round of applause because I worked hard and I felt that the thing that was being applauded was good. And then there are times where I got a pat in the back from somebody maybe a little bit more famous than me or maybe a little bit more well-known than me. And it didn't quite feel the same. And the results weren't quite as long-term positive as I would have thought they were. Which leads me to I wanted to get at something, Rob, that we were talking about earlier. You when we were doing the pre-show talk, you were talking about this whole idea of like the goal setting and knowing what it is that you're after. And you made this analogy of a lottery ticket. Like it's easier to buy a lottery ticket or get a retweet than do all this spade work to get to the point where that applause comes in.
Yeah, I think, well, some of that is surrounding the idea that I think it's come up in our conversation even during the podcast that we manage the things that we measure. It's kind of this principle saying or whatnot for software architects and whatnot. But I think it applies in a lot of in business and in creative activities as well. When you're making some observation about, okay, I'm publishing this thing and I am measuring the traffic to this thing. And I'm going to start to manage a bunch of stuff surrounding that to try to, make it more popular or what have you. But
get my metrics up.
Yeah. And sometimes that's just a lot more tangible than those, the other sort of more soft things, the things that are more, that could be measurable, but maybe haven't been expressed yet, like goals.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out ways to break that down into something more tangible that I think is kind of like an artist coming up with the quantifiable ways, even if they're kind of soft, that what change do they want to see in the world when they bring their art into existence? So do
and
you want
to be
make
specific, right?
Do you want to make one person pee their pants from laughter,
yeah,
right? 100 people. Do you want to make 1 million people, you know, chortle and, you know, spit their sandwich out, right? I don't know.
Right. right, yeah. Right. And having that specific goal will inform a lot of those choices you make in terms of how to get the word out about it, right?
And it's a feedback loop back into the creative process too. Because chances are if somehow the numbers are very big, that may be affecting what medium you're even trying to work in and the kind of messages you're trying to do. So maybe it's all about making the right groin shot YouTube video.
Yeah.
And not to insult that, because a well-timed groin shot, I can, you know, tear up with laughter.
No, Tom Sito, the great Disney animator and later on animated feature director, said that, you know, when Beauty and the Beast was played overseas, the wordplay jokes didn't translate well and people didn't get them. So like Cogsworth the Clock makes a joke about Baroque architecture and he says, if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it, right? And that's a cute little wordplay that we get in the United States. But when they translated it overseas, it didn't quite work with those audiences. But when somebody got hit in the butt with something, regardless of what culture you're in, you know, if somebody's pants fall down, they get hit in the butt with a thing, it works as a laugh every time.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your position is on that kind of humor, we can't argue with like its communicative value. But, you know, it's like what you're pointing at is another thing that I think is part of this bigger picture of like why, you know, people go, please RT, please like my Facebook page, et cetera. That's the story that always gets glamorized, right? Is that like this video was just put on YouTube and it got 1 trillion hits. Okay. What's the story after that? What happened after that? Kevin Nalty, he's another guy I got to write up for the show notes. He wrote a book on how to become a success on YouTube. And one of the things that he made a big case out of in that book is how much work goes into it. How much work, how much community building, how much knowing your voice you have to do. It's all the stuff we talk about in Lean Into Artcast, but it was in this book about making YouTube videos. And he goes ahead and dispels all these myths of, yeah, you know, this video got 60 million hits or whatever. What happens after that? You know, are you just going to be a flavor of the month? Or are you just going to be like a thing that was featured on the nightly news and then forgotten about? Or are you going to, you know, try to leverage that and be creative with it? And one of the things he said that is more crucial than getting a lot of hits was consistently putting out material. Consistently putting out material of a certain quality and get better at it. Which, you know, that's like that's the most basic advice under the sun. And that sounds like, it almost sounds like it's letting you off the hook in a way until you sit down and try to do it.
Oh, it is incredibly difficult to both find your voice and then somehow connect your voice to the audience you're trying to reach.
Heck yeah.
It's really, 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 really hard.
I was watching Power Rangers in Space the other day. Love Power Rangers. But I know what it is. Right? I know it's not high art. It's Power Rangers. It's guys in rubber suits punching each other, right? But that's what I love about it. I love all the faux heavy metal guitar work, the guy with the raspy voice singing the theme song, and then big rubber monsters, you know, shooting lava out of their mouths. And as I was watching it, it occurred to me that, you know, this is exactly what I'm trying to get out of my work, for better or worse. You know, it's like, I know in my heart that I'm intentionally, or not intentionally, but I know that at this point in my life, I do not have an Eisner winning story in me. And I was okay with that. But then the next question is does that preclude ever having an audience? Right? I mean, and if that's the case, I have to live with it because I found what I really get lit up by, and that's the only thing I can pump my energy into 110% and feel satisfied with the work. But, you know, when you look at a screen and go, this thing that only 9-year-olds really love, but then most adults kind of scoff at, or at best go, oh yeah, I remember that show. If that's my highest aspiration as an art, am I in trouble? Am I a madman? But that's rhetorical. You don't have to respond to that. I'm just saying that, you know, finding your voice. Actually, I don't know where I was going with that now. I think I just went off on a divergent path.
No, I don't think so. I heard that there's a specificity that is difficult to find. And it's not just talk about, oh, wah, wah, it's difficult. But this is that essential, I think, feeling behind our you know, the message of getting the applause you deserve is that, and I was throwing out numbers as far as how many people you would want to make laugh in whatever situation. It's that specificity of, okay, you know, you want to be this exciting source of awesomeness for 9-year-old kids that would likely enjoy something like the, you know, the Power Rangers. And that kind of specificity is ridiculously freeing. It may sound like it's a trap or may sound diminutive because, oh, compared to, you know, this high art thing that really made me, you know, tear up and think about life.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that that silly rubber suit show doesn't move me. You know, that's exactly. But what that all that means is like, wonderful. Now you're just not a part of that specific audience that you are that I'm trying to reach here as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so for me, I have met, honestly, okay, I'm just straight up. I've met two people that really freak out over Art Geek Zoo, genuinely.
Wow.
But I've met two people that have this kind of feeling about it where they get it. Yeah. Maybe even more than I get it, right? And
that's a very strange feeling when that happens, isn't it?
It is a very strange, yeah. And it was really cool. Like one person is someone that I actually that has become a friend and whatnot. But the other person I met at a convention, that they actually went there looking for me, which is pretty crazy. But true. And it was like, yeah, there's this thing that occurred between us where there was I had the feelings and the emotions and the creative process, and I put it out there, and somehow transmission was received. And yeah, that felt pretty awesome.
Yeah. And that transmission would not have been received had you not, and you've talked about this in some past Williams Art Casts,
mm-hmm.
is, really beginning to understand what you're trying to achieve out of the work and being able to communicate that through the work.
Oh gosh. Yeah. It's exactly that. And I do think, and maybe thinking only about how your voice becomes more and more specific, I'm hoping to, grow and learn as an artist to, hopefully reach more people than that.
Well, sure. But, of course.
But at the same time, and I know that that is true with other things I've done too. Like, I mean, Guitar Fretter has, definitely a larger audience than that. But at the same time, if I looked at and started comparing my success, we had a podcast about this, about comparison, right?
Oh yeah, we did.
There may be some, some resonating themes between this one and that one, but because perhaps some of this comes from that. So we're hardwired to see this, compare ourselves in like meaningfulness to one another in a, societal sense. Right. So, mm-hmm.
And I know we talked about this during our comparison episode, but this, and I know I've railed about this in other discussions, is this whole concept of life having a schedule. And that's something that really is one of the last big carryovers from like 150 years ago of the Industrial Revolution and the modernization of education, is that, you're 17, you're in 12th grade. You're 11, you're in fifth grade. And 24, you graduated college. 26, you start having kids. That's the schedule. Mm. And if you deviate from that schedule, you somehow not succeeded in some way or another, unless you've had wild financial success. And then all bets are off. You can do whatever you want. Everybody's going to forgive you. If you're a movie star or if you have millions and billions of dollars, you pretty much are okay.
Jet around town in a go-kart that has whipped cream cannons.
Yep. And he's an eccentric millionaire.
Yep. Oh, well.
But I want to back up just a second.
Yeah.
And I think that this schedule thing is related to what I was trying to get at with this whole idea of the YouTube million hit video, and then asking the question, what next? Right. When something goes viral, and then all these viral gurus came along, and I'm a viral media expert, I love that one. I'm a luck expert.
what that says to me, that claim is essentially saying I'm a walking 2 million votes.
What are you, a walking 2 million votes?
Yeah. Let me touch your project. Woo, 2 million votes.
Bippity boppity boo. There you go. But yeah, so it makes me wonder that when somebody is saying, please RT, or hey, dear person who is more well-known than me, could you please RT my thing? Could you link to my thing? Could you talk about it on your website or whatever? What is the result that they're really aiming for? Okay, this is the weird thing. Okay, I'm going to kind of go off in a whole bunch of different areas, and I'm hoping you can use your angler skills, Rob, to fish me back in. The internet is great because it took away this whole notion that we got to go ask permission of some guy to do our thing, right? I started in comics just before the real boom of the internet, so I remember the days when I had to send pitches to publishers, and when that was the only option. And I want to dog ear that because I got a thought on that I want to follow up it as a closing thought. But then comes along the internet, and it's like, oh, awesome, I don't have to ask a guy permission to do my thing anymore. But in a way, you kind of still do, because if you want it to be a business, you have to do it right to meet with the right audience's approval. So like when I turned in a project to a publisher and they said, no, this isn't really for us, your art needs more work, or the story's not very interesting, I'd have to go back and evaluate what they said and like rejigger the whole project, or maybe come up with a brand new one and give them a new project. And I went through this with some companies until I landed on like my first standalone, you know, story. And that's kind of what you're doing with the public when you're trying to build an audience too, right? I mean, I don't want to paint too grim a picture on this, but you're trying to get, the public has become that guy who says whether or not you get to make a living at this thing. And yes, you could be smart and you can work all sorts of different business strategies and everything, but ultimately you're trying to win over the enthusiasm and adoration of an audience. And that means that you're going to have to do, just like getting a publisher to pick up your work, you got to have good material, thoughtful ideas, creative ideas, got to have good production values or whatever for what you're trying to achieve and so on. And I think that this whole, because we're still in these Wild West stages of the internet, there's all these snake oil salesmen who come along to say, well, now that we've disintermediated the publishers, here's all the shortcuts to building an audience. Here's all the tricks to building an audience in order to, like, so we're so high on the fact that we don't have to ask permission to do it anymore that we think that we somehow deserve an audience, and we'll use all these cheats and tricks to get an audience. When what we really should be asking ourselves is, if I don't have an audience yet, how can I get this message to them? Is it something in the work itself? Is it something in the way that I'm delivering it? Let me look at what I'm doing here to figure out why I don't have that audience that I want yet. And then figure out what, like you said earlier, what audience do you even eventually want? Now I finally take this long, long path to get to where I was going, is that when somebody's asking for the, hey, famous person, please RT my thing, what is the result that they're hoping to get out of that? Is it, and I got a couple different things that I think it is, and I don't know which one it is, and I don't want to say definitively because everybody's probably got their own reason, but it could be A, they're looking for intimation of a relationship between them and that famous person, right? You get Mr. T to endorse you on Twitter. Hey, foo, click this thing, or I'll pity you, right? Now Mr. T said that I'm cool, right?
New life goal, writing it down.
I don't know if he's on Twitter. I wonder if he is. He probably is. But yeah, so it could be that maybe you're trying to get like the intimation of a relationship with this person, which is kind of skeevy in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Or B, you're hoping that their audience is going to, you know, if they leverage like a, you know, several million people audience, and the law of averages says 10% of them are going to click your thing. That's 100,000 visits that you got to your website that day. And maybe 10% of those will actually stick around. So now you got 1,000 new fans out of that thing. Well, that could be. But my guess is it's the third one, is that they don't know. That it's just I'm rolling the dice. I'm buying the lottery ticket, and then I'll have made it to the place where Mr. T is, where he's all the success he's enjoying with all these people following everything that he's saying. Now I'll be elevated to that level, to whatever level that is. And if it's the third one, that makes me kind of sad, because it means that they're not thinking about those goals and how to get there. It's more of just like it's that lottery ticket idea.
It is, and perhaps it's sort of an oversimplification, because, boy, it's really hard to contemplate infinity and complexity, right? But it sure is a lot easier to think that there's this one barrier. There's this one, if I get this chance, this thing, if it's bestowed, perhaps, and it's, gosh, it's everything's way too easy to oversimplify. Cause thinking about, I remember when I first started, and I never went down this path, but one of my first, serious creative paths that I started to experiment with was, being in a band. And, there's a lot of different hurdles I needed to clear and whatnot, but I formed a band and I started thinking about, well, how did someone like Nirvana make this work? Right. And it really can seem like in casual observation, you're just seeing sort of these key milestone events and this, and probably you're not seeing very many of them where only the few that were like just near the end of a large success where now you become aware of them. Because I didn't live in where they were touring locally or whatever, right? So probably the Seattle area. But
this has been talked about in like a lot of software circles lately with like the whole draw something.
And Angry Birds. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Angry Birds is another one of those stories that has been getting kicked around a lot lately where, once we get the big story that they got bought for X amount of big piles of money, then we go, wow, what an overnight success. And then we always overlook the years and years and years of turmoil that led up to that final last-ditch effort that just happened to pay off. And again, I don't want to attribute that entirely to luck. Luck plays into it, but it also is a lot of failures mean that you are learning to make a better thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're taking more and more precise, calculated risks to... and sometimes, sure, it could be near the end of someone's resources, where they are doing one more effort, but and as far as why that one succeeded over the other ones, it's probably because for all they learned, for all the other, like for Angry Birds, they made 51 other games,
yeah,
that weren't mega successes, that you know, then their 52nd game was the huge, which I'm referring to an article on Fast Company, The Dirty Little Secret of Overnight Success.
Yeah, I think I read that too. I must have read it from the link. Did you post a link to that recently? Yeah.
I probably did. Once in a while, I get internet withdrawal and I just blank out, tweet things.
You show up, you scream like 60 things in the room and then you go away again for 3 weeks.
That's kind of how it's been lately. but I think that comes from, it's a lot easier, especially when you're just getting introduced to something where you see the simple, the big milestones. You don't know that, well, they became a very effective, honed band as a machine. They practice for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours in a crappy little practice space.
The Beatles when they were in Germany, that kind of thing.
And they rocked the hell out of people when they got in front of them. And that thing, when you are rocking the hell out of someone with something you created, you're making that genuine connection. It's out of those connections that it becomes possible to then spread. Because whether we want to or not, when we meet something that hits our interests and our fancies so well, like for me, like this article, The Dirty Little Secret of Overnight Success, this has been an idea stuck in my craw for ages. And they give it a cool voice. I dig the article. Of course I'm going to tweet that thing.
There you go. Mm. You know, it's like something I've said in a less generous manner in the past was, please RT is implied in... a tweet. Is implied when you share something on Facebook. Plus one is implied when you post to Google Plus. You, by sharing the thing, you're saying, I hope you like it. To say, oh man, I knew this kid, and this goes back to that oatmeal comic too. I knew this kid in junior high. Poor kid. My heart goes out to him when I'm looking back, but at the time it was just so aggravating. He would ask you point blank, do you like me? On a constant basis. Do you like me? Do you really like me? And after a while, I was like, dude, stop. Stop. We're both 13. We're both really uncomfortable with ourselves as is without you bringing that into the picture. You know, if I'm here and if I'm talking to you, I like you.
I want to laugh and cry at the same time.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what was going on in that kid's head, but he would say, he would just, you know, he's like, you don't like me, dude, or do you like me? He was just constantly asking for evaluation on where our friendship stood. And it made it really hard to be around that guy all the time. You know, and most of us have known somebody like that, or maybe even have been that person at one point or another, and we saw the negative impact that has. And now there's this thing where the internet has all these buttons to tempt us into saying, don't forget about those buttons, don't forget about those buttons. And I also want to back up and say, like, again, just to qualify, you know, I have contacted friends in the past to say, hey, I got a big thing coming up and I could really help. It'd be a huge help to me. Like, these are like people like guys like you, guys I talk to on a regular basis, people who know me well. Mm-hmm. I'll email them and say, I got a big thing coming up. If you feel like it, it'd be awesome if you give me a little bit of a boost, you know, just, mm-hmm. just mention it. And that comes out of, not to make excuses for myself, but that comes more out of, I don't count on all of my friends staying on top of everything I'm doing. I don't stay on top of everything they're doing, and I would appreciate a reminder sometimes they got a big thing come up they want my help with. But I don't, in any case, I don't expect them to be aware of every project I got going on. So it couldn't hurt to just say, hey, X, Y, and Z, I got a thing. It'd be cool if you gave me a little bit of a blast or whatever. But that, again, that's like asking people that I personally know. And then every once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody, you know, saying like, hey, Jersey, you are a comics advocate. And it's clear to me from listening to your stuff that you want comics to succeed. Well, another way you could do that is by helping out my project. And I'm like, I've never met you before. And thank you for saying nice things about me. But no, I'm not going to endorse your thing. Not unless, you know, engage with me first, dude. Kiss me first. Really?
Dinner. It's easy to get into dating metaphors and stuff.
Yeah, but yeah. I think I should draw the line right there.
Yeah.
But you know, there's also this very simplistic, and the oatmeal did this, and I don't want to call the comic simplistic because I think that it was a very well done, well executed comic with a clear call to action that is easy to wrap your brain around. And going back to something you said a moment ago, Rob, which I thought was incredibly compassionate of you, is it's our brains work that way. It's tough for us to crunch big numbers. So to digest something and distill it down to a single to a five-step thing is very, very compelling. It's very, and it can be extremely useful too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But where was I going? Oh, this potentially oversimplified thing of like, look, you want to be famous, just make something awesome. That sounds dismissive to me.
Mm. Yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah. That's kind of like how we started the conversation.
Yeah.
Or early on, where I was really, and I don't mean to just be repetitive, but it is very hard to find your voice and reach out and transmit it. And I don't want to, just oversimplify that with, you know, the solution is to then just, you know, go kick butt and, you know, be bold and do it. Don't do the lame thing. Do the awesome thing.
Believe in yourself, Rob, because you can do the impossible.
Where you know, that can be handy if you're, you know, thinking sad thoughts or what have you. But sure. Once you're past that and really trying to wrestle with this difficult pain in the butt where you want to somehow help or entertain and educate, you know, some group of people, be it a large or small audience,
mm-hmm.
It's worth pointing out that that is a difficult endeavor, but it can be made more doable by, let's see, how do you find your voice? I don't want to say this. It sounds like a platitude, but there is this exploration that I think is, it's one of those kinds of explorations where you may kind of know where you want to go and you may kind of not know. So it's a bit of discovery and it's this, you know, I'm sure there's lots of after school specials on this.
I got to be that guy with a group of teenagers who introduced them to the cold, hard facts of life in a way. And I watched the look on their faces register that I just became that guy. Where I was like, welcome to the real world, kids. Because one of them said something about wanting their work to be perfect. And I said, gosh, is that what you want? is that what you really want? And they're like, well, yeah, that's what I want. I'm a teenager. And I said, you know, I don't ever want my work to be perfect. I want to be always in pursuit of perfection, knowing that I'll never get it. And the kids were all like, oh, whatever. And I was like, no, think about it for a second. It's like, you drew your best page today, the best page you're ever going to draw for the rest of your life. You're 17. What's the point of going on tomorrow? You know, because the page you draw tomorrow is going to be just as good or maybe even a little bit worse than the one you did today. You know, think about that. Now you've got like 70, 80 years to go, maybe more, you know, and you're going to go through all that just repeating the same stuff over and over again. That's awful. And then I saw the look on their faces. We're like, oh, he just gave us like a really depressing thought that we have to come to grips with this fact of I'm never going to be perfect. And I have to be okay with that as I try to get to it, you know. I don't know if I did a win or fail on that one. I don't know if I totally sucked in teaching these kids this, or if I did them a service. We'll find out in 20 years when one of them comes after me. But you know, it does sound stupid. It doesn't like a platitude. But you know, if you don't, it seems to me that if you don't have a love of the journey itself and a love of the process and a love of picking a refining the stuff along the way, then all you've got left is madness. Either you're perfect or you suck at that point. It becomes a binary system of either I lost today or I won today. And I think about something, oh gosh, another link I got to put in the show notes, Brandon Dayton. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to put this into as a topic for discussion. Brandon Dayton, this is an old post of his. It was actually 2 years old, but I go back to it probably once every 3 or 4 months because I find it so compelling and thought-provoking. It's a post he did analyzing the book, The Neverending Story. And I won't go into all the details, but he talks about how the key conflict of the book is Sebastian's battle between the two devils. And one of the devils promotes an attachment to worldly affairs, the intellect, logic, and making things with your hands. And the other devil tempts him with the allure of imagination and the creative power. And the challenge is to find a balance between those two things. Because if he goes into pure imagination, then he's negated his worldly self and he's become like a phantom. If he becomes fully engaged in the physical world and becomes obsessed with that devil, then he's become soulless. And the path is down the middle. Well, what's the path down the middle? It's the work. It's getting lost in making the work itself, because when you've surrendered yourself to the work, you're not listening to those two devils. They're in service to you now. Your hands are making things because you're commanding them to, and your imagination is responding to the needs of the project itself. The only salvation is in the work. And I've been up to my ears this last 2 weeks on a freelance project where I don't have time to be sad. I don't have time to think about, oh, woe is me. I'm not as famous as this guy, or I don't have as much money as that guy. Or I don't get as many retweets or likes on my Facebook page as this other guy. I just got to get this damn thing done, and I got to do it as good as I can in the time that I've got. And I'll tell you, I think about Brandon's post on that every time when I get into these stints, because I feel so much more, I don't want to say at ease, because I'm a nervous wreck because I got so much pressure on me with this deadline. And trying to, like, okay, I've got 15 minutes to make dinner, you know, that kind of thing. I'm a wreck, nervously and intellectually. But emotionally, I feel like I'm on an even keel. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I think the somehow weaving of the things that are just very disconnected, where you have the whatever's driving you to create this thing and the act of creating it and the sharing it and how you deal with that, both in how you how you get it out into the, how you introduce it to people and how you react and interact after that. Yeah, I don't know if that, let's see, and to be at peace and sort of centered on it, obviously, I know that to me, that speaks to a lot of satisfaction in just continuing to work at it. Yeah. Right. Where I guess if you have that kind of feeling, as I mean, if you think about the hours you put into this, then just, I guess, get pragmatic with it, right? Where you're going to put a lot of hours into working on your creative pursuits.
Yeah.
And well, what's that experience going to be like? Is it going to be that anticipation, the self-loathing, the you know, some over exuberance that, you know, has a lot of ups and downs or whatever. It sounds like in your situation, you're not coasting through it. You're a flirt. You're like the Tasmanian devil of
I'm exhausted.
Busyness and activity, but
yeah, no, it's a ton of work. It's a ton of work, and it always has been. But it's like, I think back to my first days of doing a webcomic, and I said the same thing everybody, or most everybody, says when they start a webcomic. You put a few pages online, and then you take the bait and get that stats tracker, you know, AW Stats. Remember that one? I forget the other ones that were popular at the time, but anyway, you get that, and it's like, oh, I got 50 visits today, and then tomorrow I got 49 visits, and then Thursday I've got 25 visits, and then I make the impassioned cry to the heavens, where's the traffic? I put the stuff out there, where's my traffic, right? And again, when I said that, what do you want it for, kid? If somebody would have come along and said, like, what do you want it for? I'd be like, I don't know. I want people to watch my stuff. You know, oh, well, do you have any kind of plans to, like, turn this audience to paying customers? Like, what kind of fans do you want? Who do you want reading this stuff? And what do you want them to actually do with it when they get it? I couldn't answer those questions at the time. And it took revising and iterating and trying out different kinds of strategies and trying out different kinds of storytelling in order to get to where I feel like, and I still don't feel like I have a command of it. I still feel like I'm faking my way through it. But at the very least, I feel less urgent about it, less of this sense of, oh, here I am, I haven't done it yet, and so-and-so won an award, I guess I failed, right? Because let's go back to, and this is the point I wanted to dog here about, you know, having to ask, like, a publisher for permission and how this disintermediation sort of frees us from that, but at the same time, we're still in the same boat. When I turned in a project to a publisher and they came back to me and said, boy, the writing's great, Tom Root wrote it. And they said, but the artist, ooh, he needs to work on his stuff. And it was hard to take that. It was hard. And they gave me some really constructive criticism, like, this is bad, this is bad. Boy, you call that perspective, and et cetera. And it was a tough pill to swallow. And at first I sat down, I was like, well, screw them, man. I know what's good. My stuff's worthy of getting in. And I knew it wasn't, but I was just saying that to sort of, like, lick my wounds. And then when I sat down and looked at the criticism they gave me, I went, oh, good point. That's a good point. Maybe I do. Well, I don't quite agree with that, but I definitely agree with these 3 points. And then I sat down and I revised and I practiced the work again. So this is going to sound like something a million other people have said, but so you don't have a million people visiting your site. So what? That's an opportunity for you to evaluate what you're doing and how to make it better without the pressure of a huge audience watching you.
So you're like Nirvana playing one of your early gigs, and, you know, you got one person to, you just start a one man mosh pit or something, but then a lot of people were just busy standing around chatting, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatnot. And then you start to think about, well, what caused that person to, what connected you to that person versus the other people? And you can think about, and it's not a pandering thing. It's about making people feel something and transmitting your art. It's like the signal is getting lost in the noise sometimes. And, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, so I guess for you, when you got that feedback, how did you feel? How were you at that state of your artistic development as far as your creative voice? So,
right.
Yeah.
I was only, I want to say 20, maybe 21 at the time.
Okay.
So I was only a few years out of high school. You know, you feel like you're old at 21, but wasn't. I was still a kid. So I felt like I was good enough that I had a handful of books behind me. I had like 3 or 4 mini comics, 24-page, 40-page comics behind me. So I knew my way around a page enough to where if somebody said, give me a close-up, give me a faraway shot, I could do it. But I was still at the stage where I was kind of mimicking other people. You know, I didn't, there was no Jersey Drozd look to my stuff yet. And I don't even know if there is now, but I'm sure there's like a quality that probably somebody could define of like, they know that I drew it when I did it, maybe. But that wasn't there yet. It was just me aping other people and trying to get at this thing that I was working on. So when I got that criticism, it was a hard pill to swallow, but inevitably I realized that there was some merit to it. I didn't just acquiesce and roll over and say, okay, well, I guess they're right. I'll just do exactly what they told me to. It was, well, let's try something different now. And let's take those things into consideration when I do that. And you know what? The next project I did was a project called Art School Girls, which was published in Antarctic Press's magazine. Now, that's not its own miniseries or anything, but I got my first published thing after I backed off and said, well, let's try something different. I failed. Let's learn from the failure, make a new thing. And I made something that made a publisher go, cool, I'm going to give this a chance.
So I just think that I'm not trying to, you know, throw you on the big old Ewok throne and carry you through the village. But
oh, God, please don't do that.
as fun as that may be.
I promise I'll be twice as prissy and uptight as C-3PO.
I suppose. I never even thought of you as C-3PO until that statement. So anyway, but I bet you could pull off a good C-3PO. Let's see. But I think in your example, it's interesting that you had enough of a sense of your voice where you were able to take some critique and evolve from there, but not in a blind way. And I don't know what else that is, like resilience and humility and all that kind of stuff, where if you don't have some kind of that detailed understanding where you're not looking at it in the oversimplified way anymore, you're willing to really peel back and then realize, boy, I guess I'm going to keep peeling this back probably forever. But I know as I'm doing it, I'm going to be somehow better at my art. And
you're talking about looking at your art and your, I don't know what you want to call it, your career, like a human being, right? And I think that changes the way you interact with people too. When you go to, hey, famous person, give me an RT, plug my thing, would you? I don't know you, but please plug my thing. And I remember we went through what I consider to be the three options of what's happening there. Either A, they're trying to get the famous person to imply a relationship, which is dirty pool. So we'll say that's a not very human thing to do. B is you are hoping to leverage their audience to eke out 10% of 10% of them, which I'll give you from a business building standpoint, you know, that's pretty smart. Still don't know if it's entirely cricket, but it's smart. I'll give it that. It's calculated, and there's a real goal in there, which at least that I can applaud. Or C, it's playing a lottery ticket. I want to be famous, and I just want that fame, and I'll ride anybody's back to get to that fame, right? And that's C, that shows a less of a appreciation of what fame actually is. Appreciation meaning understanding as well as appreciation. But also, in all of those cases, you're not treating that famous person X. You're not treating Mr. T like a human being there, are you? You're knocking on his door, and you're saying, hey, please tell all your friends. This is where I'm like paraphrasing that the oatmeal article. Please tell your friends about me. You know, that's not respecting the man's privacy. That's not respecting the man's right to choose what he, you know, wants to promote. And you could say like, oh, well, I just want to make him aware of me. Well, you know, you could, there's other ways to do that. You could also just say like, hey, I made a thing and I had you in mind. Send him an email with a link. You know, I made this because yours been such an inspiration to me and just want to share with you. That's cool.
Sure. Tribute.
Tribute.
There's another, so yeah, the tribute might be one end of the spectrum. The other end is, well, there is a pretty well-established model for making business arrangements with people. You can always hire someone to connect with them professionally and or seek to be hired by them. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a more manageable sense, sometimes you can advertisement, right? I mean, mm-hmm. at some point, maybe we'll do advertisement on the Lean Into Artcast, right? And that would be through arrangements as it is. It would be essentially paid placement during our content.
Absolutely.
And that kind of thing is a common business arrangement. And I guess maybe because it's common, and maybe it would perhaps depend on how it gets treated, but it's polite and it's expected.
Sure.
It's common enough. So there's ways, right? So you could pay essentially if Mr. T has a blog, you could say, can I sponsor your blog for a day, for a week?
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, and then there's a real value exchange, and there's parameters set on what that relationship is. Again, yep. dealing with somebody like a human being, saying, I know you've got boundaries. I've got boundaries too. Let's see if our boundaries can meet in a Venn diagram style in this one particular use case, and then mm-hmm. we can go back to our lives. And if it results in more conversation between us, awesome. I would love that. But, you know, it just reeks to me, and I don't want to accuse anybody of anything. I'm not saying like if you say please RT that you're automatically this guy, because there's lots and lots mm-hmm. of reasons to say please RT. I've said please RT before, but I'm just saying that having been the recipient of some of these like, hey, please plug my thing emails, please promote my Kickstarter, even though we don't know each other, and then also witnessing mm-hmm. other people who I respect sometimes, you know, saying like, hey, famous person, please retweet my thing. I feel like this just needs to be responded to a little bit. So it's not a blanket statement about retweeting, but it is responding to a certain condition, a certain spectrum of conditions of retweeting. Does that sound right?
It sounds right.
But it reeks of high school. It reeks of that bad 80s Patrick Dempsey movie where I only got to be a popular kid for a week. But even in that, he hired her. He gave her money to pretend to be his friend. So there was a value exchange. I'm talking about can't buy me love, right?
Yeah.
Even in that he paid her to pretend to be his friend to make him popular. But then we went through that whole thing about how he lost all of his real friends. And then ultimately he was outed and so on. But that's neither here nor there. But I'm reminded of that kind of attitude of, if I only got there, everything would be all right. And that's where I get just kind of wary. Weary.
Well, can I point out something in that dynamic that I think everyone who's listening to this, and I know or both of us, we've certainly seen it before. I think what's implied is that it's devaluing what you're creating.
Yeah.
You're saying that...
You're saying my stuff isn't good enough to hack it on its own. I need this celebrity endorsement in order to make people actually pay attention to it.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
That was a harsh way to put it. And it's not as simple as that. That is a simplistic.
Yeah, it's the celebrity on stage saying, you know, hey, my cousin made this crappy invention. Give him a round of applause, everybody. You know, he'll be in the back of the room at his table. If you like me, check it out.
You know, this is kind of tangential, but I want to make a mention of this because I thought this was really cool. I forget what website it was on. I'll find it and link to it in the show notes. I just jotted it down. Did you hear about that at C2E2, Shia LaBeouf showed up with a comic that he self-published and was selling for $20 a pop?
Really? No, I did not hear that.
Okay. There's an
$20 bucks a pop? Was it graphic novel size or was it big?
I don't know its full length. It was a hardcover book, and it was more of a picture book. It was less of a comic and more of like a series of drawings that he did with like some snippets of narrative and some comics tools, some comics narrative devices in there. But
sure.
People agree across the board, it's not very well drawn, you know? And I'm reading the article, and it's like they're sort of like framing it like, I've read the Shia LaBeouf comic, and it's a window into madness, you know? And... It's kind of poking fun at it. And I was getting a little bit of that...
Schadenfreude?
The Schadenfreude of like, oh, Mr. Big Shot actor tries to play in my pool. And, you know, so we're going to shoot him down. And I'm getting a little bit of that kind of tingle from it. But then at the end, the writer of the article did something really nice. They had a little Rob Stenzinger on one of their shoulders because they said, you know, anybody reading this will agree it's not very good. Said, but at the same time, the dude's doing what we all say that people should do. J- just make the comics. You'll get better at it. So even though this sucks, and even though he's probably getting more attention for it than he deserves because of his celebrity standing, at least the dude's getting in there and making the comics, and we cannot make fun of him for that. And that was such a great, that was the thing I appreciated about the articles. It took me on that ride of, yeah, let's jeer the celebrity. But you know what? We're not that bad. We are not going to descend to that level. We're not going to let ourselves be that kind of person for long. Let's also stop and say, good job, dude. You know, I didn't enjoy it, but good job.
That is awesome. I honestly, yeah, when you, you know what? Let all the celebrities make comics. You want something that draws people's awareness to the art form.
My only criticism is that he went to C2E2. Dude, go to a Hollywood press junket and promote your new comic. Oh. That's where you got to be making that noise. If you're going to leverage that celebrity standing to promote your book, do us a solid, as the kids say, and promote comics as a medium as well while you're at it. Then not only will you get our support, but we'll salute you. We'll all get up and say, oh, captain, my captain, and stand on our desks if you do that.
Now, I could totally see it either way because I think it's, I would imagine, celebrities forming bands, they probably play small venues.
Yeah.
Also.
Oh, well, I don't know if we got anywhere with this, Rob. I feel like we made a few cogent points, and that's all that's important to me. Go ahead.
I think it's fun to you know, sometimes where we try to wrap our heads around what we explored, but at the, then sometimes it's like there were so many nuggets along the way, it doesn't quite make sense. But now I've got the urge to try since we're at that marker. So this is kind of a one of the goals that I set forth for myself that led me to, it's interesting as you start working on, it's like forming your taste, building up skill, trying to get a desired effect out of skill and having that inform the new goals, which I'd end up performing, like how you adapt and the situations you put yourself in and all that. Like this is kind of thinking is what led to me being a part of Lean Into Art.
That was a good case in point that I should have brought up a long time ago. The reason that we're sitting here talking right now is because I was doing my outreach through a podcast I did with Mark Rudolph and Kevin Cross called Art and Story at artandstorypodcast.com. You became a listener of that. I don't know how you found the show, but you engaged with
it. Neil Gaiman mentioned it or something.
Yeah. I think it was. I think Bruce Boxleitner on Twitter said everybody should listen to the Art and Story podcast. And I knew what a Space Precinct fan you were. So you followed, you know, diligently from what the celebrity told you to do because there are betters. And you landed on the show and you loved it.
You got me. No, Art and Story is still it. Yeah. Awesome show.
So we were doing the show and you engaged with it. You know, Jeremy Burley of optichouse.com, I should put that down too for follow up in the show notes. We jokingly called him Art and Story or number one when we were doing that show because he had a high level of engagement with what we were doing and he never ever asked for anything in return. He was just engaging for the pure pleasure of engaging with this material, this publishing or whatever you want to call it, product. That he got a lot of value out of. And so he just talked to us. He sent us voicemails. He sent us emails. And when we had a forum, he posted in the forum and gave us a lot of input. And it wasn't always critiquing us. It wasn't always like, hey, Jersey, you talk too much. Or stop laughing. That was the common one that I got back then. But it was, hey, I listened to what you said on this. And I had a few thoughts that I wanted to throw on top of that. What do you guys think? Mm. And because of that, he became a valuable he became a valued participant in the overall project. And we called him Art and Story number one as a result of that. And I remember making a big case out of that. Like, do what Jeremy did, everybody. All he did was engage with us as a human being, acted like a human being, and we responded like human beings. We don't want you to be, blind followers who just do our commands. This isn't the Kiss Army, you know, or the Twit Army. I really get itchy about names like that. I really worry about anything where it's like, you know, you're down there. I'm up here at this like platform and I'm yelling at you and you shout when I tell you to, you know? You know, that was the whole Art and Storyers thing was like, you're fellow warriors, you know, we're all, yeah. we're like Braveheart, right? We're going to moon the bad guys. But that's what you did. You came in and you just engaged. And as a matter of fact, I remember when we were doing the Art and Story Supreme service, which was a subscription-based extra feature stuff, you subscribed. And then when you noticed that, hey, it's really hard to get the extra podcasts because we couldn't create an RSS feed for them because it's keeping behind a subscription wall. And so you posted a tutorial on how to more easily download the extra features. Who was this for? This was for the other people who are subscribing. And it was for us, the content creators. And you didn't get anything out of that. There was no gain. You didn't say afterwards, and by the way, guys, please RT. It was just like, hey, I like what you do. I find value in it. And I'm returning X amount of value in my own way. And then that got us talking more and more because like, wow, Rob's a good guy. He clearly gets something out of what we're doing. And, you know, it started the conversation, which when Art and Story started ending its final days, I turned to you and said, hey, Rob, you want to do a thing? You know? So.
Yeah, it's finding your voice and connecting with others and practicing that, that's going to be far more valuable in the end. As far as, you know, I'm not trying to put a tiny button on this whole giant complex topic because it's giant and complex. Need I say it again? It's really hard. But that pursuit is, it's going to lead to probably better art than an instant upvote kind of thing. You know, if that happens too, because you know what? You may find yourself in the situation where you've made a genuine connection. You made someone who just happens to be, you know, famous.
Yeah.
That has a big audience that they're like, my God, I am moved by this thing I saw or heard or what have you.
Or even like somebody who's not necessarily famous, but is somebody who you have a great admiration for, right?
Ah, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was just thinking of a case in point from my own life because, look, I talk about my life because that's the thing I know the best.
Sure.
But when I met Dan Mishkin in 2006 at Heroes Con in North Carolina or South Carolina, I forget which Carolina it's in, I went up to talk to the man, and all that was on my mind was, I want this man to know what his work meant to me. That's all I had. That was my agenda. I just wanted him to be aware because I know sometimes you can do really great work and people don't tell you. So I try to make a point of when I'm in a place where somebody who I really have a deep respect for is there, I got to tell them what their work meant to me. And I got to point out three specific things they've done that really affected me just so they get that. I want to pay them back. And I went up and I told the man what was on my mind, what was in my heart and all that stuff. And then he came back to my table afterwards and we talked a little bit more. And then throughout the weekend, we talked a little bit more and found out we had a lot in common in terms of our opinions and outlooks and things like that. Fast forward 6 years and now the man is genuinely my friend and we're working on a project together. That was not on my mind in 2006. I did not say, oh, I'm going to go talk to Dan Mishkin and I'm going to lay out a few key choice phrases that are getting him to be a little interested in me. And then, you know, and then X is going to happen. No, I just wanted to share something genuine with the man. And I did, like a human being. And then it just so happened that we got along. And now here I am years later, actually working on an agent represented project with the man. I don't want to like say like, oh, look at the success of my life. I'm just saying that.
That is like by far. Okay. So your story, that what would it take? Maybe a minute and a half to share that with us? That's about how long it took you to get this success, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was that
fast. Minute and a half? That's the pain in the butt with this, where it's like, it's easy to share the story or see the high-ranking whatever, Angry Birds.
In hindsight, too.
Do the quick observation. Way too easy to do that. Where, yeah, this was a creative partnership 6 years in the making, right?
Yeah.
And also that applies to having, you know, customers and people that enjoy your art and connecting with your service. And that's the same kind of thing where you're going to be playing the small venues. If you have a handful of people that are really interested in what you're doing. That's how everyone starts. And, and then it can go from there. And, anyway, it's And that's where the wheels fall off all my explanation, because the wagon falls into the infinite abyss of complexity.
Yeah. And it's tough to manage complexity and to think about infinite numbers and all that. But you know what? Then if that's the case, try meditation. It might help with that. No, I got another closing thought. And this is where I'm really grateful to be doing something like the Comics Are Great show, where every other week I'm talking with a brand new group of people that I may have never talked to before. And like I said before, it's like I tried to think of it as the Dick Cavett show for cartoonists. And a while back, I had a cartoonist by the name of Scotty Young on, and he's famous. He's got, you know, in tens of thousands of Twitter followers. So he's like the definition of famous. Big name at Marvel, you know, so on. But that's not why I took these words to heart. I took these words to heart because I thought they were a really nice, lovely way of looking at it, is when he said something to the effect of, you have to ask yourself, what if this is as good as it gets?
Mm.
And I thought, gosh, you know, we've got this story that we like to tell ourselves that we're always supposed to be getting better. We're always supposed to be getting richer. We're always supposed to get more secure. We're always supposed to have more and more respect and so on. But what if this is it? And then he said, he followed that with, and you got to be okay with that. And I thought, wow, it hit me like a bowling ball. I was like, I got to look around me right now. And you know what changed when I did that is I said, this isn't that bad. I'm doing a lot of neat stuff that I'm really, really happy about. And it made me appreciate what I'm doing right now a little bit more. You know what I mean? Not to say like, oh yeah, my house is a ramshackle hut and, you know, but I'm not going to have any ambition about it, because what if this is as good as it gets? No. It means that look around yourself and say like, all the things that I'm doing right now, all the energy I'm pumping into it, what if it's going to be this way forever? Mm. And are you okay with that? Right.
And that mindset, I think you're just a bit less desperate to reach out for that lottery ticket.
Yeah. Like, remember, speaking of lottery tickets, just a couple weeks ago, there was that that big national lotto was up to like some ungodly amount of money. I forget what it was, but it was a butt ton of money, and all the news agencies were talking about, have you gotten your lottery ticket yet? Have you gotten your lottery ticket yet? And I talked to a couple of friends. We're like, I got mine. And I turned to Anna, I'm like, well, everybody's talking about it. Do you want to get one? She's like, nah. You know, it's like I'm cool with the way things are here. This is fine. We don't need to, you know, pin our hopes on getting the lucky drawing of numbers. But then I said to her, I was like, you know, it's always the person who never plays who wins. We've never played, so this is our chance, you know. It didn't work. But yeah, you If you're not desperate, if you are comfortable in your own skin, and if you are engaging with people like a human being, I think you're going to get more substantial payoffs. And when you get that applause, it's going to be the applause you deserve rather than the applause you had to try to find a clever workaround in order to get. I think we summed it up together.
I think we did.
High five.
High five.
Okay, so if this stuff, this is where I implore the audience to do something. If all this thinking about stuff, if it appeals to you, dear listener who's listening right now, if you guys walked away with the last hour and 20-something minutes and said, hey, these guys, they make me think a little bit harder, or they make me feel good, or hey, they puzzle me and I got to crunch on this for a bit. I wish there was more. Boy, oh boy, we've got a sponsor and they've got more. That's at leanintoart.com/workshops. That's where you can get even more of this content from us, more in-depth content. We've got some class. I don't know if we want to spotlight any particular class right now. I guess I can go there real quick. Leanintoart.com/workshops. And this gives me a chance to say the URL again. Let's see. Yeah. What do we got in there that's good? We got a lot of stuff in there, so I can just like grab out of a hat. How about, I want to go into one of the more philosophical ones.
I'm super curious what you're going to pick.
Well, I'm going to say who needs art anyway, actually, at the risk of sounding like nepotism. This is Kate Shield Stenzinger, Rob's wife. But
yep,
the woman came in and was a white tornado of crazy knowledge on child development and using art to speak to different developmental levels and understanding. I mean, we talked about this a lot in the last episode, You know, like different stories are designed different ways to speak to different developmental levels. And we can laugh all we want at the Wiggles, but there's something really compelling and unique about Hot Potato, Hot Potato. That repetition is used for a reason, because that is what we call inculcation in teaching and so on. But it's not just confined to young developmental levels, right? She goes pretty far afield from, you know, early childhood to later on, right?
Oh, yeah. And then also the students in the class were reacting to some of the sort of the timelessness of what she was presenting in how to nurture creativity in true. Kids is like, well, wait a minute, that actually would nurture creativity in an adult too.
That's true.
And a lot of what drove the creation of the class was trying to think, well, people who have strong creative interests and creative careers, and or, you know, a combination of, you know, both side pursuits and day job and all that, what are some interesting ways to encourage creativity in kids? So, and honestly, it really did apply to all ages, in my opinion. But then again, I don't have her master's degree in psychology.
Well, we were both there too to sort of act yeah. as translators in certain respects to mm-hmm. like the working cartoonist or illustrator as well. Hour and a half of content, $25. It's a lot of really in-depth content that I think it jives very well with what we've been talking about today. Nurturing creativity, finding your voice, you know, creative strategies to get at ways to look at your project or little games to play to inspire your own creativity. And that gives you access to the Lena Tartt forum, where you can also follow up with us personally, and we also post extra podcasts in there. The Lean Into Art warm up is what we've decided to call it.
Yes. Which is fitting, because it's what we do before we do this podcast.
Yep. We hash about with some ideas, and what blows my mind every time is, like, I walk into the Rob Stenzinger dojo and I'm like, oh, I'm just going to say hi to him, and then all of a sudden he vanishes and then he lands on my shoulders and I got to react quickly. And the next thing I know, I'm fighting for my life in a philosophical sparring battle. No time to say, like, hey, how's the kids? No, it's fight time. It's always fight time, and never take a moment for granted in the Rob Stenzinger dojo.
That's because I sit in my sensory deprivation chamber before we meet for at least 1 hour.
So yeah, all that is yours. If you go to leanintoart.com/workshops, and that's how we support the show. That's how we pay the bills for our hosting mm-hmm. and for the technology we use to do the video casts. So benefit to you, benefit to us. $25, hour and a half. And there's all sorts of other classes in there too that you can check out. So that's our sponsorship message. So, hey, Rob.
Hey, Jersey.
Did you think it was going to be this, that we're going to have this much mileage out of this topic? I didn't.
Oh, you know what? Much like my creative voice in general, I may not know exactly what's going to come out, but I have some trust. The trust has been growing. So
that's cool. Yeah, I'm starting to get that way too about the show. It's like just a few minutes before we started and asked, like, what are you guys talking about tonight? I'm like, you know, I don't know. I'll jot something down real quick as something that I've been thinking about. I don't know if there's any mileage in that, but, you know, if I pitch something at Rob, all I got to do is say it in a sort of declarative manner, and Rob will quickly circumvent that and find more thoughtful approaches to it, and we'll get some airtime out of that.
As you do for me. And you're like, well, you're talking in that alien language, Rob. Let me translate this for the rest of the world.
you green-blooded Vulcan. All right. So, okay. Well, thanks everybody for downloading and listening. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And until next time, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Please argue.
And yes. And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user LeanIntoArt, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners.
Thanks for listening.